G'day listeners, you're tuned into the Natives Rouseabout podcast. I'm your host Trent, and today I will be joined by Mitch and Matthew to talk about the 1997 Australian comedy film, The Castle. I think I'm pretty good company for this one, as Mitch is one of the ANA's foremost cultural experts and commentators. He always has some good insights and analysis. How are you going, Mitch?
I'm going very well after that pump up, Trent. Great to be on the show, and really looking forward to launching into a classic of Australian cinema on this podcast.
Nice. We're also lucky to have one of the ANA's high-soaring legal eagles, Mr. Matthew Grant. I know he's been doing a little bit of reading and research on the Mabo case, so I'm sure he'll be able to educate us on the legal side of the story told in this film, and with a bit more accuracy than just the vibe. How are you going, Matthew?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Glad to be back on the show, and my props for your recent episode on the Snowy Hydro scheme. I quite enjoyed that, so glad to be here.
Oh, good. Glad to hear that too. I hope the audience will be delving back into the back catalogue and listening to some of our older stuff as well. All right, let's start, as always, with some listener comments. We had Kyle Smith. He commented on the Magic Pudding podcast episode that you did, Mitch, with Michael, and he said, "I enjoy the discussions and the literature that you guys highlight. I write a little here and there. Poetry seems to be inspiring me recently. I have early memories of my dad and grandfather reciting Lawson and Paterson. Never understood why we never studied them in high school or university literature classes. Keep doing what you're doing. Regards from Gippsland." So thanks, Kyle. And I'm in agreement with you, because I also didn't have any Lawson or Paterson in my high school education. Is that the same for you two boys?
Yeah, I think we may have actually dealt with this one on the Magic Pudding podcast. It might have come in before that, but I'm certainly happy to speak to it again, because that reflects my experience as well. I know it was something that my parents sort of spoke about with their generation, and you know, they kind of look back on that fondly and nostalgically, and say it's a shame that that's not the case these days. There are a couple of reasons for that. I think one is that obviously there's been this move away from anything traditional in terms of not just promoting positive vision of national identity, but even just adhering to a conventional structure or maintaining a sense of order. Free verse is very much the rage. And that was, I think that movement was kind of ideological at first, but from my experience speaking with and working with English teachers at different stages, I get the impression now that because that kind of more traditional structured poetry and things like verse and meter have been neglected for so long, and obviously this isn't just relevant to traditional Australian poetry, relevant to romantic poetry and going back even further, neoclassical stuff and even the works of Shakespeare, verse and meter, they're just not that well understood anymore. And so teachers as well as students are not particularly well versed, if you'll pardon the pun, in scanning poems for meter and understanding how different meters actually create meaning and accompany the subject matter of the poem and work together with it. So I think there's probably two reasons for that. One of it's ideological, and one of it is one of them, which maybe stems from that ideological neglect, is that they just don't know how to teach it anymore.
I know in my experience, we actually did Henry Lawson's Drover's Wife in, I think it was year eight, I think. So there was, I mean, not a terrible Lawson story. I mean, there's obviously a lot of other bangers that could have gone in its place. But I seem like, having gone through life, I feel very blessed in the high school education I got in terms of literature and history and politics, because like, I got a whole lot of education, obviously not necessarily in a positive light, but at least exposure to a lot of Australian stuff in high school from the actual curriculum we did, including even just touching barely on Lawson in The Drover's Wife. But the other thing for me, though, as well, is when I got to the age of, 16, or maybe I was 17, I actually really got into Lawson And shout out to Ironbark Resources for having all the Lawson poetry up there. I remember sending some of it to my English teacher, and he was a bit perplexed, for lack of a better word. But yeah, no, I definitely touched on it in school. But why they don't do it, as you know, why they didn't do it at my school more, and probably why it doesn't get touched on at all. As yeah, I mean, Mitch is right about the nature of poetry and the form of verse. You know, that's everyone's kind of lost understanding of these things, like myself included. But I think if I were to think about it, really, the whole curriculum is trying to teach you that Australia has no cultural heritage, and that basically anything that would indicate there is a cultural heritage, which isn't just lowbrow, toxic, evil, terrible things, they're trying to erase it, really. It's just leftist psychopathy that's taken over the academic system. That's my take on it anyway.
If I can jump in there, Matt, you mentioned that there are some other bangers, or plenty of other bangers out there as far as Lawson's short stories go. And I'd have to agree. I think his short stories are far superior to his poetry, to be honest. I think that was his real strength. And obviously everyone knows The Drover's Wife. The Joe Wilson stories are really good as well. And one that I would put out there, because a lot of his work is pretty bleak, Drover's Wife included, A Double Buggy at Lay's Creek is probably my favourite, because it does kind of show the harshness and the difficulty of bush life. But it's got this really sweet and quite uplifting end that, to be frank, you don't see in a lot of Lawson's work. So yeah, A Double Buggy at Lay's Creek is one that I would recommend to all listeners as a much more heartwarming head story.
And while we're on it, because you've made a recommendation, I can't help but throw one in as well.
Fair enough.
Lawson's Shall We Gather at the River is a terrific short story about reuniting of a town after a bushfire. So strong recommend for that as well.
All right. Well, after all this poetry talk, that's launched us into our poetry segment. So the poem for this episode is going to be The Dream of Wearing Shorts Forever by Les Murray. So here it is. To go home and wear shorts forever in the enormous paddocks in that warm climate, adding a sweater when winter soaks the grass, to camp out along the river bends, for good, wearing shorts with a pocket knife, a fishing line and matches. Or there were the hills are all rolling down below the plain, to sit around in shorts at the evening on the plank veranda. In the cardinal points of costume are robes, tat, rig and scunge. Where are shorts in this compass? They are never robes, as other bare leg outfits have been. The toga, the kilt, the lava, the Manhattan cotton dhoti. Archbishop and field marshals at their ceremonies never wear shorts. The very word means underpants in North America. Shorts can be tat, land rovering, bush environmental tat, socio-political, ripped and metal stapled tat, solidarity with the third world tat, tiam asi, likewise track and field shorts worn to parties with the further humid modelling negligee of the kingdom of flaunt, that unchallenged aristocracy. More plainly, climatic shorts are farmer's rig, leathery with salt and bone meal, are sailor's and branch banker's rig, the crisp golfing style of our youngest male national costume. Most loosely, they are scunge, ancient Bengal bloomers or moth-eaten hot pants worn with a former shirt, feet, beach hair, sand, and a paucity of signals, scunge, which is real negligee. Housework in a swimsuit, pyjamas worn all day, is holidays, freedom from ambition. Scunge makes you invisible to the world and yourself. The entropy of costume, scunge can get you conquered by more vigorous cultures and help you notice it less. To be or to become, it is a serious question posed by a work shorts counter with its pressed stack, bulk khaki and blue, reading Yakka or King G, crisp with steely warehouse odour, satisfied ambition, defeat, true unconcern, the wish and the knack of self-forgetfulness, all fall within the scunge ambit. Wearing board shorts or similar, it is a kind of weightlessness. Unlike public nakedness, which in Westerners is deeply circumstantial, relaxed as exam time, artless and equal as the courtesy of a hussar regiment. shorts and they're plain like, are angelic nudity, spirituality with pockets, a double updraft as you drop from branched pool, ideal for getting served last in shops of the temperate zone. They are also ideal for going home into space, into time, to farm the mine's Sabine acres for product and subsistence. Now that everyone who yearned to wear long pants has essentially achieved them, long pants which have themselves been underwear repeatedly and underground more than once, it is time perhaps to cherish the culture of shorts, to moderate grim vigour with the knobble of bare knees, to cool bare-knuckle feet in inland water, slapping flies with a book on solar wind or a patient bare hand beneath the kajaput trees, to be walking meditatively among green timber through the grassy forest towards a calm sea, and looking across to more of that great island and the further tropics. All right, lads, that's a bit of a departure from our usual fare. I thought we needed to take a break from riding on the backs of Lawson and Banjo. So what did you think of that one?
Yeah, they've done a lot of heavy lifting, Banjo and Henry, so fair enough, we better give them a break. But, to be honest, looking at the run sheet, maybe I didn't have the latest one, Trent, but I didn't even realise we had a poem lined up for tonight. So I was just trying to wrap my head around the mere fact that we had a poem tonight, and that might set a record for the longest one, I think. It's an ode to the national costume, as it says right there, and it speaks to my experience as a Melbourne schoolboy. You know, obviously there are references to the tropics and heat and humidity there, but this is a part of the Melbourne schooling in a boys' school in particular experience that in the depth of winter you just keep wearing your shorts no matter how cold it gets. And it is a point of pride. It is a symbol of identity. There is something inherently Australian about that we probably overlook. And no, I like it. I'd need to go back and unpack that to get the most out of it, I think. But no, on a first listen, it speaks to me. And as I said, my Melbourne schoolboy experience.
Yeah. The shorts need to make a comeback. I mean, you just look at these Lowe's ads from the 80s, you know, high socks, tie. Yeah. Short sleeve, button up, and shorts. It is such an energy. It is, you know, spiritually finds its roots in, you know, like ancient Troy. You know, like you need to have the warm wind blowing between your knees. You know, this is where a man breathes, as it's been said. I really like in this poem that line, satisfied ambition, defeat, true unconcern, the wish and the knack of self-forgetfulness all fall within the scunge ambit. Wearing board shorts of similar, it is a kind of weightlessness, mate. Like the satisfied ambition, defeat, true unconcern, reminds me of the expression erectness of carriage in A.A. Phillips' Cultural Cringe. It's like the self-confident Australian chud with the moustache and shorts, you know, just an ungovernable race back in the day. You know, America's Cup, Crocodile Dundee, freaking the Bicentenary, 1988, things were happening, you know. The shorts were like the zenith of another era of Australian destiny. So, yeah, I am a shorts enjoyer. Thanks for sharing that. That was a banger.
Shorts nativism, we're making it happen. Right.
Activated.
Yep. I was looking through just Australian poems, and I was trying to find something that was at least tangentially related to the castle, and the title of this one sort of struck me, which made me click on it and read it, and it just had this sort of thread of enjoying the small things in life, just getting joy out of wearing a pair of shorts. And I thought, you know, that captures something similar to the spirit of the movie that we're going to be discussing today. And it was close enough for me to throw that in as the selection for today's poem. That's enough poetry. Let's move on to the topic at hand. And I've written a little introduction, which I'll read out now. The castle may seem like an insignificant comedy from the 1990s, but beneath its cheerful exterior lies something deeper, a story about Australia at the end of the 20th century, a country trying to understand itself after the rapid changes that followed the Second World War. There is plenty of evidence that this movie holds a special place in Australian culture. Many of its lines have slipped into everyday speech. everyone knows exactly what it means when someone says a gift is going straight to the pool room. The movie's shooting locations have become minor tourist attractions. You can book an overnight stay at the Bonnie Doon Holiday Home on Airbnb for around $120 a night. And it's no surprise that last year The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald conducted a public poll that named The Castle as one of Australia's favourite films. On a recent rewatch, I was struck by the depth of its subject matter. Yes, the film is a light-hearted comedy, but it subtly opens a window into Australian class politics, urban development, eminent domain, native title, and the uneasy assimilation of new Australians. Daryl Kerrigan represents the ordinary Anglo-Celtic battler coming up against the forces reshaping modern Australia, mainly rapid urban development to meet the needs of a population explosion driven by immigration. The title of the film comes from the saying, "A man's home is his castle," and the movie treats the home as a repository of family history, memory, and identity. The Kerrigan family, they take pleasure in the small things, home-cooked meals, time with family and pets, Mrs. Kerrigan's crafting projects, and the DIY inventions of the family's ideas man, Steve Kerrigan. When expanded outward from the family home and onto the nation as a whole, the film's underlying message becomes one of valuing local culture over global homogenisation. The idea that a man's home is his castle translates naturally into the belief that a nation's heritage is worth protecting. With all that in mind, I hope our audience will see the value in today's episode topic, one that I think will be rich, revealing, and well worth revisiting. So can I have any comments from the co-hosts on the cultural legacy of The Castle? Did either of you grow up in a home with a copy of The Castle on DVD or VHS? Have you heard anyone drop lines from the movie in your day-to-day life?
Yeah, absolutely. And knowing now that it's only $120 a night to stay at the Bonnie Doon house that was used in the film, the only thing I have to say to that is we're going to Bonnie Doon, I guess. So, yeah, there are many classic lines. I think my favourite one is probably "What is it with wogs and cash?" personally. But, yeah, straight to the pool room is obviously a classic. Yeah, so I remember fairly clearly, I suppose, the film actually coming out. I would have been in grade 3 at primary school at the time. And the major point of interest there for me was not so much the film. You know, at that stage, I was too young to appreciate it. But, you know, there was a family friend of a friend who had some connection to the house that was actually used for shooting the film. Not Bonnie Doon, but the one out the front of the airport. It was, I think, for anyone who's interested and wants to, if you're based in Melbourne and you want to drive past the site, number 3 Dagenett Street. So it backs onto Essendon Airport. It's presented in the film as being Melbourne Airport, but it's actually Essendon Airport in Strathmore Heights. And tragic irony that the house that, you know, is to be taken over and demolished in the film as part of the airport expansion has now been demolished and replaced with a couple of fairly modern and bland-looking townhouses. There was a little bit of a campaign to try to get some heritage protection, I believe, and that, yeah, that fell through. So, yeah, bit of a sad note there. But, no, I became aware of the film, Trent, and oh, not aware of the film, but I watched the film probably for the first time in secondary school. And yeah, was very much taken by probably at a superficial level, sort of just laughing at the shenanigans of the characters without kind of realizing that depth or appreciating that depth that you speak of there. But I think my appreciation of the film has developed and matured. And, you know, Daryl Kerrigan is not exactly fighting the same forces that we're fighting today, but as part of what we do, but there are certainly some parallels there that make his campaign and what he's trying to achieve resonate with us today, I think. So, yeah, it's a classic. I've always appreciated it from the first watch, but, yeah, my appreciation has also developed and grown over time as well.
For me, I actually never heard of the movie until I was in, like, grade 8, I think, in high school. We actually studied it in English I did like a full-on film academic review of it in high school. If I could dig that up, that'd be amazing, but I hadn't had any luck. But yeah, the cultural impact of this is massive. I mean, the expressions in the film, you know, you mentioned the pool room, has been mentioned of Bonnie Doon. I mean, I will regularly shout, tell them they're dreaming, just any opportunity I can. And I've got other relatives in the family that will throw out just Castle references just randomly. So it can't be disputed that this has had a significant impact on Australian contemporary culture. And, you know, I think, yeah, it's a disaster that the actual castle itself has been bulldozed to make way for some, what I presume would be some white rendered disgusting flats.
I think it's a grey render actually, but they're pretty ordinary.
That's a war crime against Australia, honestly.
Yeah,
No compensation for when those get bulldozed.
Absolutely not. Just one thing then, sorry. You mentioned the cultural impact. One thing that has struck me as particularly curious about the extent of the cultural impact of the castle is that it is universally across Australia pronounced as the castle, including here in Melbourne, where I am, where the film was made, because historically there has been this divide where people in most of Victoria, I think Tasmania as well, but I won't say that with any certainty. I'll just speak for my own fair state here, pronounce that word as castle, which I think is at odds with maybe the rest of Australia. But I have noticed now that in more recent times, castle, not just in reference to the film, but more broadly, if I've heard that term used, seems to have, if not become dominant, certainly become much more prevalent. I can find no studies or analysis of this, but I do wonder if the film has been responsible for changing the way that the word is pronounced in Victoria. And I'm curious as to why it was pronounced that way in the film, given it was shot in Victoria. I would love for listeners to, if they know anything about that, to provide any insight.
Yeah, amateur etymologists, hit the comment section and let us know what's up.
Please.
Yeah. That's interesting, Matthew, that you studied it in high school. Like,
yeah, we did. Yeah. Class.
Yeah, I did. I wasn't aware that it was in any school curriculum. It sounds like your school had an awesome curriculum. You were doing, sounds like, some pretty good history and poetry and watching the castle.
Yeah, shout out to Mr. Cullen if you're listening. Patriot.
Well, that's just further evidence of the cultural reach of this film, that it's made its way into classrooms. Before we go on and get into some plot synopsis and analysis, I wanted to talk a little bit about the filmmakers, the production, and the reception of the film. The film was made by a production company called Working Dog Productions. So they also produced a bunch of TV shows, Frontline, Thank God You're Here, Russell Coit's All Aussie Adventures, The Panel. They made a few more movies. The only other notable one was The Dish. And currently they're producing the ongoing TV series Utopia, which is on ABC. And I think we'll circle back around to Utopia maybe at the end, make some comparisons about the underlying messages in the film and that TV series. Working Dog Productions is made up of Rob Sitch, Santo Solaro, Tom Gleisner, and Jane Kennedy. And some of those names will be familiar to people. And I'm sure if you look them up on Google and you see the images of them, you'll be like, I've seen that person on TV before at some point. They're all quite, you know, moderately famous and get their heads on TV. These guys all got their start on The D Generation, which was a comedy sketch show on the ABC in the late 80s. And out of that, they went on to form Working Dog Productions and produce The Castle. That's who made the film. The production. The film was produced on a tiny budget, $750,000. So for reference, The Wiggles made a movie the same year and they had a budget of $1.6 million, more than double the budget of The Castle. The Titanic also came out that same year. They had a budget of $200 million, but we're getting into a different category of movies with that. The point I'm trying to make is The Castle was produced on a really shoestring budget. There's some pretty innovative ways that they kind of cut corners and save money. For example, the family's called the Kerrigan family, and that name was chosen because there was an existing towing business in the area called Kerrigan Towing, and they were willing to let the crew borrow their trucks. So I won't burden the listeners with heaps and heaps of Castle trivia, but I think I've made my point. The production schedule was also very, very quick. The script was written in 2 weeks, and then it was shot in 10 days. So very lightning fast production. Working Dog Productions, they did not access any government grants. Now, I'm going to have to do a little bit of a tangent here and discuss government film grants, the historical reasons for their existence, and I'll let the audience know what the current form is now. The Australian film industry, it had been effectively smothered in the cradle by Hollywood. The larger and more developed US industry took control of the distribution pipelines, beginning way back in the silent film era. So local cinemas, they struck distribution deals with the major American companies, and that heavily shaped what could be shown, when, and for how long. I'm talking back in the era when, you know, the film would come in a big canister and go to the local cinema before it moved on to the next one, and there would be showings at certain times of day, and there would be deals between the distributor and the cinema on how many times the film would be shown and for how long, etc. The effect of this is that there was very little room on Australian cinema screens for locally produced product. Hollywood commercial dominance was so strong that the Australian government viewed it as a serious national issue, and they started introducing a system of grants and investment schemes to try and cultivate a movie industry locally. The Australian film industry has dozens of these state-funded entities that have come and gone over the time.
It's actually interesting you mentioned that. Charles Chevelle, he was an Australian filmmaker. I've got a few of his films on DVD. They're published now by Umbrella Entertainment. But in the special features of every one of those DVDs is like a one-hour documentary on exactly this issue about how the Hollywood, literally mafia-connected, like Hollywood individuals beat all of the local cinemas into submission. They basically said, if you want to be licensed to air American films, you have to basically only air what we tell you to air. So they had these extremely heavy-handed licensing arrangements with all the Australian cinemas, which totally crushed the film industry. Charles Chevelle being a victim of that whole process. I mean, he's the filmmaker who created Sons of Matthew, Rats of Tobruk, 40,000 Horsemen, Heritage, Wake of the Bounty, and a few others. A massive, massive figure. But yeah, it's a massive, like there's almost a whole podcast on that issue alone about the whole Hollywood dominance of the film industry, but we'll leave that for another day.
Definitely something that we might look into revisiting. Get in the comments if that's something that you're interested in, let us know. This system of grants and investment schemes, it still exists today, but the Australian film industry, even with all of these, all of this state funding, they appear unable to produce quality movies nowadays. And the model seems to have shifted towards trying to attract Hollywood productions to come and film in Australia instead of producing our own homegrown stuff. There is a federally funded Ausfilm office in Los Angeles that tries to entice US productions to come and film here and offers them a 30% location offset. So a location offset is a cashback scheme. If a film is shot in Australia and a certain amount of boxes are ticked on using Australian cast, using Australian crew, VFX, staying in Australian accommodation, hiring Australian equipment, if you can show that you've done all of that, the government will refund a portion, a pretty significant portion, 30%, of the money that you spent on producing that movie, in addition to the individual state governments. That's just what the federal government does. So when you see, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean 16 is filming on the Gold Coast, this is part of the reason why, because the federal government and the Queensland state government are ponying up a big chunk of cash to do that. The Film Finance Corp, which is the corporation that would have financed the castle if they had gone down that route of trying to get state funding, they were reasonably successful. They ran between 1988 and 2008. They funded some movies that we would have heard of, Strictly Ballroom, Muriel's Wedding, Priscilla, Chopper, Wolf Creek, Rabbit Proof Fence. So those bigger movies did make their money back. The model of the Film Finance Corp was to kind of invest in films. Any comments, boys, on those film grants? Is this money being spent wisely?
Look, as a principle, I support film grants in the same way that I, in principle, support like the ABC. It's just, unfortunately, the creative minds that have taken control of these things are giant cosmopolitan retards, basically. So in a nativist restoration future, there will be state-funded media, but it will be on a good management technique so that the production is actually wholesome and good for the nation.
Yeah, much the same from me, Trent. Again, supportive of the idea. And look, credit to the Whitlam government and Gough himself, I guess, where it's due. I suppose even a broken clock is right twice a day. But, you know, some of these films that were funded in the 70s and the 80s, the new wave of Australian cinema, you know, they are masterpieces, things like Pinky Rock. And you know, that I'm absolutely supportive of works of that kind of quality and which do kind of speak to our genuine Australian identity and even to the extent that, you know, we've wrestled with the landscape, which is kind of what Picnic at Hanging Rock is all about. Yeah, absolutely supportive of that. But, you know, you see, and to be fair, I don't know if Film Finance Corporation was specifically involved in this particular film, but I can't even remember what it was called because, you know, it just looked so shit that I didn't care. But, you know, some film about, oh, there's a dying local country footy team. Oh, no, what are we going to do to save the team and save the town? Oh, we've got to bring in all the immigrants, of course, and that'll revive the town. It'll be like that experiment that they had in Maryborough where they brought them all in for that reality show. And as soon as the show was over, they all went back to their little ethnic ghetto in Melbourne. But so anyway, I digress. But yeah, much the same. Supportive of funding in theory or the concept broadly, but it's got to be funding a positive, genuinely national vision for Australia, genuinely Australian kind of identity is something that needs to be promoting.
Yeah, I would agree. It comes down to who is approving the checks. You know, if the person approving the checks is somebody who is an Australia hater, there's not much point having them at the head of an Australian film funding organisation. So it would seem that the people from Working Dog Productions were somewhat in agreement with us. So they avoided going for any film grants. They didn't want to deal with the bureaucracy, possible external interference, potentially some foreshadowing here for their current show, Utopia, which is largely about bureaucracy and red tape. All right. So the movie was a huge financial success. So on that $750,000 budget, it took in $10 million at the Australian box office. And it had a pretty strong second life on DVD. The film was released internationally. It was a success in New Zealand. Makes sense. It did all right in the UK. Also kind of makes sense. Similar sense of humor, I think. The film did not do well with USA audiences. They did not really understand or relate to the Australian humor. I have a quote here from a review in the American magazine Newsweek, and it said the movie obviously struck a deep chord in its homeland. Here, it's not much more than a light tap on the funny bone. So the Yanks didn't get it. Did well with the regular viewers. Critically, The film was generally pretty well received. It did win an Australian Film Institute Award for being the best original screenplay. Now, there's a little bit of controversy here at the movies with Margaret and David.
It takes just a little while to get rid of the niggling thought that these characters are being laughed at by the filmmakers. But then you're suddenly embraced by the enormous affection the filmmakers have for Daryl and his family. Part of this is due to Michael Caton's wonderful performance as Daryl. But the film has a number of winning performances that contribute to the endearing world of the Kerrigans. It's not the best directed film of the year, nor does it have the best cinematography. But the roughness around its edges doesn't detract too much from the heart of the film. It's a simple first effort from the frontline team, shot in a very short space of time. But for me, it was a winner. David.
Well, I'm afraid it wasn't for me, Margaret. I really didn't get onto the wavelength of this film at all. I thought it was patronising towards its characters. I didn't find it funny. It reminded me of the sort of humour that I thought had gone out with Dad and Dave 60 years ago.
Well, it's nice to know it's still around. I think it's a very Australian sort of humour.
Well, that may be. Maybe I'm just not into that kind of humour because I just didn't find it funny.
It's a matter of whether you do make that breakthrough and think, oh, no, they really like this family.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought it was silly. And technically, it really is. I mean, you say it's rough. I mean, it's very rough. Very rough.
How many stars are you going to give this?
I'll give it 1.5.
Oh, David. Oh, you really have started off not meanly. I'm giving it 4 stars.
So what are your thoughts on that, boys? Was the film patronising towards its characters?
I'm generally more of a David kind of guy. You know, may he rest in peace, the late, great David Stratton. Yeah, I tended to, throughout the time at the movies, to the extent that I watched it, find myself agreeing with him much more frequently than Margaret. But no, I'm with Marg on this one. She talks about how she acknowledges that you get this impression initially that the film is kind of talking down to its characters and sneering at them, almost making fun of them, because a lot of the jokes are sort of based around the, you know, naivety, ignorance, even foolishness of the Kerrigan family and their failure to sort of pick up on what's going on around them, and, you know, social cues and things like this when they're in the company of more sophisticated people, shall we say. But as Marg rightly points out, throughout they really endear themselves to us, Daryl and the rest of the Kerrigan family. And I was thinking about this. Yes, I'll acknowledge that I did know that this question was coming somewhat. So I was thinking about this and the Bud Tingwell character, Larry, the QC. I feel like if you don't identify with Daryl himself, I think if you do identify with Daryl himself and you feel like you're the one that's being made fun of, well, I think that's part of, you know, the Australian personality. You know, we don't mind having a laugh at our own expense. So that's probably part of it. But if you don't necessarily identify with Daryl, as if you don't sort of see yourself as coming from that working class, you know, Aussie battler kind of stock, I think you're probably going to find yourself identifying with Larry, the QC, who initially he meets Daryl and he's sort of like, oh, okay, this guy, you know, is maybe a little bit slow and a little bit dim-witted, but he can't help like him and admiring him. And despite the fact that they come from completely different worlds and social strata, they end up becoming very good friends because there's just something so authentic and genuine about Daryl that he does. He endears himself to everybody around him, you know, despite his ignorance and roughness around the edges and at times foolishness. So I think both things can be true. I think it can have a joke at the expense of its characters, but it can also really endear them to us. And I think it does both of these things, and that's part of its appeal.
Yeah, I definitely think the writers were not maliciously making fun of the Kerrigan family. I think it is true to form. The Kerrigans, I think, are quite an honest representation of that class of people. You know, there would have been countless, I mean, to this day, there are countless families that are comfortable enough to not be freaking out about everything. They're just kind of cruising. They're not deep thinkers. They're not very, you know, they're just honest, kind of good people. And so, yeah, like, I think David's review is retarded, honestly. It may have been poorly shot. I don't think it was outdated in its humour. I thought it was right on point with the stuff at the time. I mean, especially with all the Lebo bombing jokes, like that was right on the nose for the era in which it was made. So yeah, no, I thought it's a great movie. It's 5 out of 5 for me. It's not 4 out of 5. Like, it hits on a cellular level and awakens your blood memory to watch this movie.
Your cells are getting a workout, Matty.
Yeah,
I think you've said in a few recent podcasts that things are impacting you on a cellular level.
That's right. I think I might have a disease of some kind, to be confirmed.
Yeah, go get that checked out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think this might come down to David is actually a 10-pound pom who came over in that period.
Classic.
Margaret is a dinky diet Australian lass from Waverley in New South Wales. So I think that is probably something that is shaping their view of the
mystery salt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, enough said, mate. Should have started with that. I mean, it's the classic sterling spitting down on the currency. Can't like anything good Australian, you know, because it's not Anglo enough. Shout out to the Anglophiles.
Yeah, well, maybe because he didn't feel like he fully belonged with those people. He didn't feel comfortable with laughing at them. Whereas, you know, if you identify with the characters, then I don't think it's patronizing to laugh at them. All right, so that's enough about the sort of background stuff of the movie. Let's get into the movie itself. Let's do some plot synopsis. The Castle tells the story of the Kerrigans, a tight-knit working-class family living in a modest home beside mountains. To outsiders, the house is unremarkable. Planes thunder overhead, power lines cut across the yard. But to Daryl Kerrigan, the proud patriarch, it is a sanctuary built from love, memories, and the benefit that a home's worth is measured by the life lived inside it. His optimism shapes the whole family. Sal, who delights in her simple cooking, their children, Dale, Steve, Wayne, and Tracy's new husband, Con, their world is ordinary, chaotic, and full of affection. The Kerrigan's peace is shattered when the airport authority and the neighbouring corporation attempt to compulsorily acquire their home to expand the room. Most families would feel powerless, but Daryl refuses to accept that a company can simply take what he treasures. He hires suburban solicitor Dennis Denuto, whose legal skills are shaky but whose loyalty is unwavering. Their case seems hopeless. The government and corporate interests are aligned, and the Kerrigans are just one small family standing in the way of development. As the fight escalates, Daryl's determination attracts the attention of retired constitutional lawyer Laurie Hamill, who recognises that the case touches on a deeper principles of justice and property rights. In the film's most significant legal turn, Hamill draws inspiration from the Mabo decision, the hallmark 1992 High Court ruling that overturned the doctrine of terra nullius and affirmed Indigenous land rights. Mabo established that property is not merely a matter of title. It is bound to connection, history, and the meaning a place holds for the people who live in it. By invoking Mabo, Hamill reframes the Kerrigan's struggle. Their home is not just real estate, but a site of identity, dignity, and belonging. This argument carries the case to the High Court, where the fight becomes symbolic, a battle between ordinary Australians and the powerful interest, and a reminder that the law can recognise the human value of land, not just its commercial potential. Against all odds, the Kerrigans win. Their victory is not only legal, but emotional, a triumph of community fairness and the belief that a home is more than bricks and mortar. The film ends with the family still in their beloved house, grateful not for wealth or status, but for each other. The Castle remains a warm, funny, and iconic portrait of Australian suburban life, enriched by its subtle echoes of the Mabo decision, which underscore that land carries meaning, memory, and identity far beyond its market price. All right, so that was a little synopsis that I just pinched from somewhere. Let's jump into doing some analysis and discussion of the movie. And I think the best place to start is with our legal expert discussing the relation and comparison between the legal case in the movie and the Mabo case.
Yeah, sure. So one interesting thing about Mabo, which a lot of people won't know, the Mabo decision related to the Miriam people, which were a tribe that lived in the Murray Island up in the between Queensland and New Guinea. This island was essentially their home since time immemorial. Like, dates vary between 300 and 2000 years, so it could be more recent than not. But anyway, the interesting point that came out in Mabo is essentially that the native title of the tribe exists up until the point that it's extinguished. And so the question was, is this island, which to this date had not been settled by white men, had not really meaningfully been occupied by Australian settlers, whether it was truly, whether that native title was in fact extinguished by mere virtue of the Act of Parliaments or the Act of the Crown, the Royal Grant, which said that that island is included within Australia. Essentially what the High Court said, after a whole bunch of commentary, historically it had been considered that radical title, as it's known, which is essentially all land within the borders of the Crown's jurisdiction, belongs to the Crown, and that if you have possession of land, it's by a Crown grant, but essentially all land is vested in the Crown. That idea was essentially overturned. I mean, there'd been cases along these lines for decades in Australia. There was one Supreme Court case in the Northern Territory in 1971, where the Supreme Court justice, who essentially was the leading thinker in the decision, quite literally went through common law cases back to like 1605 in like North America and fleshing out whether or not the common law recognized a form of community native title. And he essentially said no. And in the case in Mabo, the High Court essentially said, like, they start off light saying, like, oh, you know, we don't, the peace and order of Australian society is built on the legal system and it can be modified to bring it into conformity with contemporary notions of justice and human rights, but it cannot be destroyed. And he basically, the High Court says, yeah, we're going to overturn, you know, hundreds of years of legal precedent because equality before the law is a aspiration of the Australian legal system and international expectations and, you know, essentially the pub test, the vibe, which is, you know, so commonly mentioned in the castle when they're standing, when Dennis DeNudo, before the QC gets involved, Dennis DeNudo's sitting in front of the Superior Court and he says, oh, it's Mabo, it's the vibe. You know, that's why you can't take Kerrigan's house off him. In much the same way, in Mabo, they just invented a massive departure from the common law, backstopped just by the vague notion of community expectations. If you were to ask a classical constitutionalist, you go ask the Samuel Griffith Society perhaps what they might think of this, they would say that if the common morality of the people wished to change the law, then they would go to Parliament and change the law. That's not the proper duty of the High Court to just change the law on the basis of what they think the community expectation is about the nature of land ownership and all the rest of it. But the interesting thing about Mabo really is it's a unique situation because the Murray Island, as I said, had been in their possession, you know, since time immemorial, essentially. There had been Christian missionaries that had set up a mission there. But essentially, unlike most of mainland Australia, they had an unbroken continuity of occupation of the land. And so they had the best case out of anyone else. Where in mainland Australia, the Mabo principle wouldn't be very helpful for most tribes where their title was extinguished, either by conquest, by alienation, by settlement. I mean, there's a whole lot of bases upon which their actual title would have been overturned, even with the Mabo decision. But what happened after Mabo is Paul Keating introduced Commonwealth legislation, which went over and above Mabo and basically created a process for native title claims to be flushed out across the entire Commonwealth. Now, that's kind of what happened in the nature of the case. Is there any comment on that before I have a quick rant about my qualms with Mabo?
sorry, if I may just connect back to the castle. I mean, that's kind of the whole joke, right? That Dennis Denudo is kind of this bungling fool and he's just standing in front of the courtroom riffing effectively, saying, you know, it's the vibe and it's Marvo, and we're meant to laugh at that and think how ridiculous it is that he's trying to speak about the vibe of this whole situation in connection with Marbo. But what you seem to be saying, Matt, is that Marbo itself was all vibe.
It was all vibe, yeah. It was all vibe.
That's quite ironic, but and amusing in a tragic kind of way. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, it's quite an interesting case. I'd encourage anyone to read Marbo number 2 and also that 71 Northern Territory case, because it actually gets into a lot more. It gets into some of the historical legal justification for annexation. You know, they're basically saying the land was unoccupied, it was uncultivated, it was occupied by savages, which have no recognizable law or a form of law which is not amenable to actual Western styles of law. And to me, a lot of that, you know, there's merit in those arguments that can be made, sure. But at the end of the day, for me, when it comes to who is the true landowner of the Australian continent, it's a bit of a mixed determination. I think one thing that Marbo missed, the big thing that's missed, is what is the significance of this radical title of the Crown to own the land? Like, why does the Crown get to own the land? There was no real justification to that, other than it was just, that's the way the law is, and there's no more grandiose justification for that basis. But I think what must be considered by all of us when we think about Crown ownership and radical title of all land in the Commonwealth is the Crown is the source of the defence of the nation. So essentially, the Crown has ownership of all land because the Crown is the thing that guarantees the rights of property ownership. You know, it's the Australian Defence Force, you know, the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force, that is the means by which we are able to have our land unsullied by overseas foreign actors, whether they be pirates or other states. And so when we talk about things like Marbo and who owns the land, you know, when we talk about radical title and the Crown owning the land, we need to weigh up the fact that the blood of tens of thousands of Australian soldiers has been squeezed out in the battlefields of Asia, the Pacific War and the Second World War, in the fields of Flanders and the First World War. So much blood has been spilt for this land. That is the basis through which there's a moral claim via radical title, because this land has been bled for. It's not just we just rocked up and have never fought for it, have never toiled for it, have never sacrificed for it. To me, if you talk about land ownership and having a legitimate claim to land, the person who has sacrificed the most for the land, I think, has the greatest moral claim to it. Just because you may have gallivanted through a field once and had a campfire and, you know, smacked some rocks around to make an axe, does not give you a perpetual claim to that land, defeating all other claims for the rest of time. Surely it may be a better claim than someone who just rocks up the next day, surely. And so to that extent, as I said before, this kind of mixed characterization, I think there is definitely a basis to support native title where the historical record demonstrates like persistent, ongoing, like meaningful possession of a particular tract of land. In that case, I think absolute fair game. Like, there needs to be some level of recompense or fair dealing with the Aboriginals. And that was the case. And I've written about this on our website before, so I won't go into it in great depth. But the thing with Marbo is really the judiciary has totally failed to do due justice to the significance of Crown radical title, because Crown radical title is soaked in the blood of our forebears. And not only the blood spilt in battle and in war, but also the collective sacrifice of all of our citizens to the Crown. I mean, you pay taxes, generations upon generations have paid taxes, they've served, they've essentially given their service to the Crown. They have followed the law even when it was not to their personal interest. I mean, there's 101 million bits of blood, sweat and tears that uplift the radical Crown title. And when the High Court in Marbo didn't do adequate justice to this, that was very unsatisfactory. I do think the right decision was reached in Mabo in relation to Murray Island, because Murray Island, I mean, we haven't occupied that, haven't used it. They haven't been dispossessed. They've been there since time immemorial. And so I think that's a fair claim. The real problem is this category error, that if the, you know, the uninterrupted continuous settlement of Murray Island gives rise to a legitimate native title claim, then therefore all the other areas in Australia are on some degree or another also eligible for a native title claim, despite the fact we've built enormous towns, cities, farming districts, we've improved the land, we've become one with the land through labour. So anyway, that's my quick rant on land law. But the other interesting thing I wanted to go on just really quickly, because I know you're all sick of hearing me rant about this stuff.
I totally agree with, you know, pretty much everything that you've said, to the extent that I understand it. But yeah, I think this is something that the average Australian just doesn't understand, because it is deliberately misrepresented. The actual nature of the connection or lack thereof that particular groups of nomadic Aboriginal people had with particular tracts of land. If they happen to pass through this once every, you know, few years or seasons or whatever the case was, it's represented as them having this meaningful ongoing connection with that land. And that's totally at odds with that situation described on Murray Island, where that it is a permanent settlement in yeah, an ongoing location, as opposed to these groups and very thinly spread groups as well. You know, there's, I think, a deep philosophical question there, like how much land can one person or one very small group of people meaningfully own and possess? How many people are we talking about in terms of Aboriginal people before British settlement? Like a couple of hundred thousand or a few hundred thousand across the whole continent? Can those people meaningfully possess, in the way that we understand land to be meaningfully possessed, cultivated, as you said, you know, that that very classical European kind of understanding of to own the land and to own property, you have to sort of cultivate it and work it. Can a few hundred thousand people spread over something the size of Australia meaningfully possess all of that land? I don't think so. So you're spot on. And what you were saying about the defense of the nation, absolutely. You know, it's kind of, they probably would resist using the term the crown, or sort of giving any deference to the term the crown. But you know, it kind of aligns with the old radical nationalist argument, doesn't it? Of, you know, we, our ownership or our place here was paid for in blood in the defense of the continent in World War II. No, go on, keep ranting.
That's all right. That's okay. Beyond all of the Mabo commentary, it's funny, this case actually reminded me of a real case in the High Court. There's been a series of cases testing out this idea of just terms. And you may think this is going to be dry, but I'm going to promise you, you're going to get something good out of this by the end of it, which everyone should know and understand. In the case of ICM Agriculture, which is a 2009 High Court case, the 51st case of that year, the High Court essentially discussed this idea that the Commonwealth Constitution says it can't compulsorily acquire land except on just terms, right? That's in Section 51. And the Commonwealth government in the Constitution has the right to essentially give grants of financial assistance to states on terms that it considers fit. You know, it seems to have this unlimited discretion, you know, like the Commonwealth government, we're going to give New South Wales $10 million on terms we see fit. And essentially what happened was, is there was a string of cases where the Commonwealth government was using their ability to dole out money as a backdoor to get around other constitutional issues it had. So in this case of ICM Agriculture, it was about the acquisition of property, essentially. And so the state government was compulsorily acquiring land and property off people without fair compensation. And it was part of a scheme that was funded. It was made a condition by the Commonwealth government. I believe it was related to some kind of environmental offsets, like, you know, there's some kind of carbon credits or something or other. You'll forgive me if that's not the exact detail, but essentially the state government was taking land and they sued it to the High Court. And the High Court essentially said, you can't use a circuitous device to avoid a constitutional requirement. So essentially, they doing something indirectly, which is something that would be ordinarily prohibited directly, is something you can't do constitutionally. And so taking something on just terms, the Commonwealth government wouldn't be able to grant money to a state to say, we have a program, we want you to implement a scheme where the New South Wales Parliament, for instance, passes a law where they can just seize land without paying them, which they can do, by the way, because they have plenary power without a limitation. But the Commonwealth government can't require a state to do that as a condition of a grant, because the Commonwealth Constitution says it can't make laws in relation to acquisition without just terms. But anyway, to the useful part of all, and so that reminded me of this issue with the airport, the Kerrigan's house is being taken and it's not on just terms and blah, blah, blah. And it reminded me of that whole area of law. But the most interesting area, like it's a really important principle, and it's enshrined in the 1990 High Court case of Caltex Oil. And in that case, the High Court reiterates this principle that either in contract, in Commonwealth law, in state law, the government or any party is unable to adopt a circuitous device with the view to avoiding the need to comply with a constitutional requirement or the requirement of a law or so on and so forth. This is relevant, like for us, for instance, when it comes to trying to create ways to circumnavigate things like employment law. So like the common area these days is, as you all would have seen, the Antoinette Latouf case with ABC not too long ago, where she was sacked for having some anti-Zionist posts on her social media. And essentially in that case, the ABC tried to hide around, you know, oh, well, we didn't sack her because of her political opinion. We sacked her because we were concerned about the reputational impact on the ABC, or she didn't follow the social media policy. Or they tried to hide behind all these things to, you know, in effect, adopt a circuitous device to avoid the need to comply with the fact that you can't terminate someone for their political opinion in the Fair Work Act. And so this concept is profoundly important, because there's been a whole string of cases in Australian constitutional history where the Constitution says you cannot do this. And so Parliament has gone about writing laws to try and circumnavigate that prohibition. And the High Court has struck them down a number of times. Now, we will be making a statement, an ANA statement on a case that we have going at the moment, reaches its conclusion in a month or two. But this area of law about adopting a circuitous device to do something which would ordinarily be prohibited under the Commonwealth Constitution is such an important area of law. It is beyond power of Parliament. It's beyond power of contracting parties to adopt indirect means of contravening the law. So, yeah, just a bit of an interesting thing and something you can think about.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And I look forward to that update when it comes, Matt.
As do I. I have a question for you, Matt. I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but what is Murray Island's status now that they have achieved native title? What's different?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I think essentially what they were trying to do in the case, the Commonwealth government was trying to build some kind of fishery setup or something of that nature. And so they were trying to essentially prevent the lease being granted to enable the company to do that construction project, essentially. In relation to its political connection with the Commonwealth, I believe it still is within the Commonwealth. It's just the High Court recognises that they essentially we are unable to grant a lease over that land. So they get all the benefits of being in the Commonwealth, but none of the penalties, essentially. But yeah, they are still within the Commonwealth in terms of they're under the jurisdiction of the government somehow.
I just looked up, and if you live on Murray Island, you are able to apply for Centrelink. We can't build any fishery stuff there. All right. Some other comments on the legal side of this. Now, this might have slipped past people in the plot of the movie, but it is mentioned. It's kind of in passing that there is a quarry on the other side of the airport that could be filled in and allow the airport extension to go ahead without taking the homes. But I think maybe that's kind of lost in the source of the movie and perhaps contributes to the sort of confusion around the way that the Mabo case is presented in the movie. One other thing that I noticed, just an observation in the real life Mabo case, the oppressor is kind of framed as the Australian government, the Australian legal system, versus in the movie where the oppressor is presented more as being a corporation, where the defender appears to be the legal system and the Australian government, which is just an interesting little tweak in the real life case and the movie that inspired it. Any other comments on the legal aspects of the movie?
Only that I guess there is the parallel, though, in that it's the High Court in both instances that comes to the rescue. Mm. I suppose. I mean, it's Laurie Moore. I think I called him Larry before. Sorry, Laurie. It's kind of Laurie through the High Court who sort of comes to the rescue. So I guess there's a parallel there. But yeah, it is interesting that the perpetrator, if you like, is kind of corporation versus Australian government. So yeah, I hadn't thought about it in those terms. It's a good point.
All right, moving on. Let's discuss the new Australians. Now, this is only a pretty small aspect of the film, but I think it's worth commenting on anyway. There is a couple of jokes. I think you mentioned at the top of the show, Mitch, the what is it with Wogs and Cash,
which I is definitely always, did, yes.
Yeah, that's a good line. There's there's a couple of instances in the movie where the Kerrigan's Lebanese neighbour, Farouk, makes some jokes. One of them, he says he likes the planes at the airport at home. When the plane goes overhead, it drops bombs. And there was another comment when the airport corporation sends some goons to intimidate him. He makes the comment,
a man, he come to my house and he say, stop with the court business. If no stop, he have friend who come and beat me. And I say, you have friend? I have friend. My friend come to your house, put bomb under your car and blow you into fucking sky.
What'd he do?
He get scared and he leave.
I bet he did.
I thought this was interesting. Farouk is obviously being presented as a, you know, a working class, upstanding guy. He's a friend of the Kerrigans, probably somebody that came to Australia for a better life. But he's still presented as somebody who will, even if it's an empty threat, make the threat of blowing somebody up with a bomb. If did you have anything to comment on with that?
Yeah, it's you're right. It is, and you know you kind of laugh at it because you're like, and particularly today, he's like, oh, he actually said that. You can't say things like that anymore. But there is that moment afterwards where he says, you know, I don't have bombs and I don't know anything about bombs, but I'm Arab, and so people just think that that's true, and that's kind of the joke. It's like, oh, we're laughing about the Arab and his bombs, but also we're kind of undermining negative perceptions of Arabs in the process. And then the follow-up line is, oh, Farouk, you bloody ripper, or something like that. So it is funny, but there is something a little bit subversive about this. And I do wonder for, you know, audiences in Sydney, I think it was around that time, maybe in the, you know, the 2 or 3 years that followed, where, you know, some of the kind of shocking sort of stuff that we've seen in the UK that's coming out with, you know, rape gangs and things like that, not on the same level, but there was a little bit of this stuff going on in Sydney in the late 90s and early 2000s, and notorious figures like Bilal, yes, Scaff, yes, and whatnot. Yeah, I wonder how some of
to bring up the Scaff brothers, which was it was around the same time as this.
You know, horrific sort of stuff. So I do wonder how some of that kind of messaging around that time might have landed with audiences in Sydney, and how that kind of stuff would have landed at the time compared to how it's perceived now, or how it would have been perceived at different times over the 30 years since. But yeah, I think there is probably something, as much as the film as a whole resonates with the typical Australian, for us and those of our ilk, I think there is something that we notice in that's a little bit subversive and maybe one of the points of the film that doesn't resonate quite so well, that, you know, Farouk is presented as just, you know, just another Aussie battler trying to fight against an unjust system, and the slippery slope begins.
Yes, yeah. There was only one other point that I had on this, and I think we've kind of said all there is to say on this topic, but I'll just include it because it's funny. In the beginning of the movie, there's a scene at Tracy Kerrigan's wedding where she's marrying Eric Banner's character, the Greek, and Daryl Kerrigan is giving his father of the bride speech, and he cracks a joke about the Greek smashing the plates, which is quite funny. And he says another line, which is interesting. He says, "I suppose as a father, you'd like your daughter to marry one of your own. And let's not beat around the bush. The Greeks have a reputation." you can sort of feel the air come out of the room.
Before, Kingswood country.
Yeah. before he brings the speech home, and he sort of lauds what a good bloke Con is. That's Eric Banner's character, and how well he treats Tracy and how he's welcoming him into the family, finishing it off with his, I can't remember the word, but he says like good evening in Greek, and which I find quite funny as well. But yeah, the same thing. It's just that little twist of subversive message just hidden within quite a humorous and nice moment in the film.
I think it's worth mentioning as well in this film, with others of its kind, like Wog Boy or Cracker Jack, you know, these kind of like early 2000s depictions of like the growing multicultural Sydney, is it's always depicting these ethnic minorities as like a kind of non-harmful, tiny number of people that just kind of fit in, and they're just great people, and there's no existential demographic crisis hinted at all by any of it. And so the net effect of these kinds of films in this way, I think, lulled most Australians into a sense of security and essentially self-confidence of demographic dominance. You know, if you were around in 2004, 2005 as an adult watching this movie and you thinking about the immigrant issue, you would be thinking of like, oh yeah, there's like the handful of Greeks at this Greek restaurant, like in the next suburb over, and there's like a few dozen of them, or like, you know, there may be a few hundred to 1,000 Lebanese people in like all of Sydney, which has like over 1 million people. And so when the immigration machine like really turned up, when John Howard's doubled the numbers, the average, like unless you were in the frontline suburbs that were getting, you know, airdropped foreigners in, you would still be in this mindset that everything's okay. It's just like in the castle or whatever, where there's these tiny, insignificant numbers of foreigners living amongst us that are essentially harmless. And so it's taken many years for that to really kind of fade away, this false impression of the insignificant, minute ethnic minority kind of cliques, you know, because now it's just, it's gone so hard, so fast. You can't go outside without realizing the existential demographic crisis that we're in.
Well, I was just going to make the point that there's nothing like this being made today, and there's nothing that I could sit down and watch and enjoy where it's just like subtly including these migrant characters and showing part of the local community. If there's anything of that nature, it's so overpowering and smashing you over the head with it that it can't be ignored. It's just not subtle at all. I'm talking about like television shows and movies. And I do wonder why are the bread and circus creators unable to make any of this this art that carries their message subtly anymore. Probably a bigger question than we're going to be answering this podcast, but that's just what was on my mind.
Oh, sorry. The thing I was going to say before, just On a bit of a lighter note, I love the Con character in this film, the Eric Banner character, because he's not like, you know, he's not like a wog boy type character. He's another kind of stereotype, which is the well-spoken wog, like the wog that tries to resist his wog stereotype by sitting at home and reading the dictionary and trying to have this cultivated, refined way of speaking, but kind of fails dismally at it and just becomes like even more of a wog stereotype in the process. And it's funny because you recognize this kind of wog in the real world, right? And he's like, I think that one line, he says, "Mr. Kerrigan, this whole process has totally restored my confidence in the legal system." like you see wogs like that, like trying to elevate themselves all the time, and it's hilarious because it just rings so true, and he absolutely nails that character, Eric Banner. So yeah, an underrated character in the film is Con. He doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue, but every time he speaks, it's like that. So
yeah, it's so true.
Yeah,
shout out to Wog Boy as well. If the listeners haven't watched that, you gotta check it out.
I haven't seen that one. I'll have to.
And Cracker Jack as well. But
yeah, I'm a Cracker Jack fan.
Yeah.
Last sort of thing I want to discuss is the underlying message of the movie, which in my opinion, I see it as being pretty optimistic. It's saying trust the system. The little guy can win. If you have a problem, you can go and hire Dennis DeNudo and, if he can't sort it out for you, you'll meet a nice Queen's Counsel in the smoking area and he'll pro bono sort it out for you. And I think that's in pretty sharp contrast with Utopia, the series that I mentioned that this same writing team and production team are currently producing, which is on the ABC, which I'll talk about a little bit now. The series is a satirical comedy. It follows the National Building Authority, a fictional Australian government agency tasked with delivering major infrastructure projects like fast rail and new airports, urban development, national broadband, and other grand political plans. The show follows Tony Woodford, played by Rob Stitch, and he is the director of the castle. And he's the wary but principled CEO who genuinely wants to build things that matter. But his team of well-meaning professionals are constantly thwarted by bureaucracy, political spin, and shifting priorities, and endless stakeholder engagement. So this kind of has the opposite message of the castle. It's something that it's just about bureaucracy and red tape, and nothing can get done, and the system is totally broken. I've got iView up in front of me, and I'm just going to read a couple of the blurbs for the episodes. Episode one, attempts to sign international development deal are compromised by a decision to redesign the NBA's logo. Episode two, Tony is forced to step in when an endangered grass threatens to derail plans for a new container terminal. Episode four, Tony is reluctantly dragged in when the developer of a low-rise inner-city building project decides he wants to double the height of his apartment block and then triple it again. So I'll stop now. But this is – I watched like two episodes of this show, and I hate it so much. It's the most nihilistic, negative, just showing like, oh, we can't like actually do anything, this government – agency, we're just absolutely pissing up all this taxpayer money, wasting our time, spinning our wheels, but like, haha, isn't it funny? We'll like make a snarky joke about it. It's surprising to me that the same people who made the castle made this, and I would like to know what happened in the intervening 20 years that's made them so jaded.
It's so true. Something bad must have happened to them, like personally, because I don't know. It's the optimism, you're right. Trust the plan, trust the system. It's all good. You can just chill. Like you can just be just nobody, disconnected, have next to no money. And Dennis DeNudo is going to, you know, conquer the world for you. It's, yeah, versus the reality that is Utopia. It's rough as.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to get a read on, you know, what public sentiment was like in the 90s. I was a child of the 90s, and so I love the 90s because, you know, I love my childhood, but you're sheltered from all that kind of stuff. You know, I know the 80s was a pretty rough time with, you know, massive recession and massive interest rates that people were paying back on their mortgages and the like. But the simple explanation seems to me that it reflects how public sentiment and public feeling towards Australia and its governance has shifted in that time. Like, everyone feels pretty pessimistic about things, right? And you know, our reasons for that, or the major reasons for that are pretty clear. But even those that are not of our ilk, so to speak, they either haven't identified the problem that we focus on, or they choose to not openly acknowledge it. They still understand that things are not good, right? So that to me is the pretty simple explanation. The opposing worldviews and the optimism of the castle versus the pessimism of utopia seem to be a reflection of public sentiment at these different periods over this 30-year span. That'd be my simple take.
I would add that it seems to be a reflection of a reality. To tie this back to the Snowy Hydro episode that we just put out, that me and Jamie did, we had a big discussion about the original Snowy Hydro scheme. And then we spoke about Snowy 2.0, how it came about, the budget increases, the time frame blowouts, and we did some comparison with it with the original Snowy scheme and its successor, Snowy 2.0, and we have regressed so far in what we are able to achieve that it's really disheartening when we started running through the numbers and making comparisons. And I think everybody is feeling that. And This show that we're talking about, Utopia, I think it's a little too close to a very sad reality for me to find it funny.
Yeah, look, I haven't watched it, but as much as those little blurb descriptions that you gave sound pretty funny, I can totally understand that, you know, watching a whole episode of that would be infuriating and depressing. But I can only assume the attitude is that, you know, if you don't laugh at this, you're going to cry. So let's try to laugh about it. But yeah, obviously it hasn't landed with you. And yeah, I don't know if I'll be watching it anytime soon.
Any other comments from you boys? Anything else to add before we start wrapping up?
No, I think this current decadent age of self-sabotage and the state shooting itself in the foot all the time and just chimping out, destroying the country, I think this era is coming to an end. I think I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. So we just need to lock in. And the other thing as well, and just as a meta politics side point without ranting for too long, I think it's so important for everyone in the ANA to find themselves in a profession that when the time comes, we can just slide into all those institutions that need, you know, skills, leadership, organization. Because, you know, it was kind of like, I remember watching, and sorry, this is kind of a bit of a side subject, but I'll just rant anyway for a minute. I'm the national governor. I have the right to do this. it makes me think, because we're just talking about this utopia stuff. It reminds me of the second Trump term, how they wanted to fill out all these departments. You know, there was this kind of heritage plan to, you know, flush out all the leftists out of the institutions, but they obviously struggled greatly to actually find people on the right page that also had professional capabilities, skills, and all the rest of it. And so if we do one day want to have some degree of capacity to steer the ship of state, it's so important to not just be a group of Dale Kerrigans who drive tow trucks, but also to have skills and expertise in various fields. But I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll touch on the Kerrigans as well briefly for my final thoughts. Actually, no, I'll touch on Dennis Denudo as well. Yeah, I think one of the other reasons that Daryl Kerrigan resonates with it, as much as, you know, the Daryl Kerrigans and the Dale Kerrigans of the world are not going to be the men that lead us to a glorious victory, I think one of the reasons that he does resonate with us, he resonated with us then and he resonates with us now, us as nativists and others who are sick and tired of what is happening in this country and the direction in which we are going, is that he may not be all that well educated. He may not be particularly academic. He may not necessarily be able to put into fancy legalistic terms or to express in an eloquent manner the injustice that he is experiencing, but he does understand the situation. He understands right and wrong. He understands that he is a victim of injustice, and he's not going to allow himself to be pushed around by people who are able to disguise their evil intentions in sophisticated vocabulary. And I think that that is that gets to the heart of Australian identity and the Aussie battler. And I think there are a lot of us, or a lot of people out there, that feel similarly. You know, I might lose to you in a debate, you know, on something like immigration or something like that. If you come with all your statistics and your fancy jargon to explain why immigration is great for this country, I might not be able to debate you on that, but I instinctively know that you are wrong, and I'm not going to cop that. I think that aspect of Darryl Kerrigan resonates with all of us, and that's why The Castle continues to resonate today and maybe resonates now differently in a way to what it once did. And just finally, I think the character of Dennis DeNudo also resonates with anyone who's ever worked in an office, because those bloody photocopiers, they just kill you. They just kill you. So shout out to Dennis.
Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. That was a fun one, a long one. And for the audience, let us know in the comments what topic you would like to hear about from us, or if there is anything relating to Australia or the ANA that you would like us to do a show on. As always, I'd encourage all of our supporters in the audience to make sure you like and subscribe and share our content far and wide. We'd love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. And lastly, if you want to reach out, you can find us at oznatives.org. Thank you.
I've been around the world a couple of times, or maybe more. I've seen the sights, I've had delights on every foreign shore. But when my friends all ask me about the place that I adore, I tell them right away. Give me a home among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair. I'll be standing in the kitchen, a-cooking up a roast, with Vegemite on toast, just you and me, a cup of tea, and later on we'll settle down beside the hitching post, and watch the possums play. Give me a home among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair. There's a Safeway on the corner, and a Woolworths down the street, and a new one's just been opened up where they regulate the heat. But I'd trade them all tomorrow for a simple bush retreat, where the kookaburras sing. Give me a home among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair. Some people like their houses built with fences all around. Others live in mansions and some beneath the ground. But me, I love the bush, you know, with lizards running round and a pumpkin vine out the back. Give me a home among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair. Give me a home among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees, a sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair.